Welcome to the Bully Pulpit from the University of Southern California Center for the Political Future. Our podcast brings together America's top politicians, journalists, academics, and strategists from across the political spectrum for discussions on hot-button issues where we respect each other and respect the truth. We hope you enjoy these conversations.
Good afternoon, everybody. I feel like I'm at a school. I should sound a little bit like a teacher. I am the president's domestic policy advisor. We work hand in glove with the president's climate policy office. And I'll talk a little bit about climate, but really I'm going to focus the lion's share of my remarks on the workforce, not just climate core, but overall the workforce that we need for to address the climate challenge and the real unique opportunity we have that this administration is realizing to address the climate challenge. When the president talks about climate change, he often talks about jobs. He connects the two very directly, and that is the work of our administration to really ensure that people understand that we have a climate challenge in our country, but we also have a climate opportunity, which is that we can lead the world in addressing the climate challenge with our investments in renewables. That will create millions of jobs, and we are well on our way. So I'm really grateful to be here at USC for this important conference, and I really appreciated the dean's comments about really not engaging in a dispute on climate change, but really how we address it. And that's exactly the way we think about this in the Biden-Harris administration. Facts are facts, and we have to deal with them. And that is why the president has made addressing the climate challenge really the heart of his work as president. But let me say a few facts that we all know across the nation. We know Americans are experiencing more of the devastating impacts of climate change. Today, communities across the country and around the world are enduring historic floods, wildfires, extreme heat, and drought. And here in California, unfortunately, you're experiencing all of those things as time goes by. And we also know that the long-term impact of climate change affects our ecosystems and our economies. And that's why it's really critical that we take action. And that is exactly what the president has done. At the heart of his agenda on investing in America is his climate response. And we know at the federal level that communities are tackling this themselves. So many Americans are rising to the challenge of climate change in extraordinary ways and really, truly inspiring ways. So we're proud to work with leaders from across the country, many of whom are in this room, to tackle this problem. But we also know that what is required is national leadership and global leadership. So that is why President Biden has delivered the most ambitious climate, clean energy, conservation, and environmental justice agenda, not just in America and in our history, but in the world. At the center of our work is President Biden's Investing in America agenda, the largest investment in clean energy and climate in history. In the history of the United States, and in the history of the world. Together, this agenda dedicates hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funding that is also catalyzing several times that in private investment to advance climate resilience strategies in every community in America today and reduce climate impacts in the future. Under the bipartisan infrastructure law, we're elevating roads and bridges above projected flood zones. We're making the energy grid cleaner, more flexible, and more reliable. We're restoring coastal ecosystems to buffer the impacts of hurricanes and so much more. And then really at the heart of the Investing in America agenda is what's called the Inflation Reduction Act, a bill that passed last year, unfortunately, really only with Democratic support. And that bill has the most significant climate investment ever, anywhere in the world. Through this legislation, we are transforming our economy by creating good-paying jobs and investing in clean energy, conservation, and the resilience sectors. We're working to install 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations. We have a goal to conserve 30% of America's land and waters by 2030. And yes, to cut America's carbon emissions in half by the end of the decade. And here's the thing, tackling our climate crisis can be a win-win for our economy and our earth, but none of these goals will be achieved if we don't have the workforce that we need. So at the heart of all of this, you know, from the president's perspective, as I said, we need to ensure that we're investing in a clean economy and resilience and in renewables, and we can lead the world in doing so. And the potential here is millions upon millions of jobs. And that's where the domestic policy comes in, policy council comes in particularly, because our focus is on ensuring that there's the workforce that can meet the needs of us actually getting to our climate goals. So we know that young Americans are rightly worried about the climate crisis and what it means for the future. And we need to harness this energy and create the training programs and opportunities to build in-demand skills for the clean economy. That's why last September, President Biden took executive action to launch American Climate Corps. The American Climate Corps is a partnership between the White House and several federal agencies, but really led by AmeriCorps. And I was really excited to hear that AmeriCorps is partnering with this conference. The American Climate Corps is a partnership, as I said, a partnership between all of these agencies and is a groundbreaking workforce training and service initiative. It will help ensure that more young people have access to the occupational skills-based training necessary for good-paying careers in growing sectors like clean energy and climate resilience. American Climate Corps will prioritize paid job training and meaningful hands-on experience addressing the climate challenge. Members might be trained to engage in restoring coastal wetlands to protect communities from storm surges and flooding. They might manage to improve health and prevent catastrophic wildfires. They might help households deploy energy-efficient solutions and cut energy bills. Over 50,000 Americans have already expressed interest in joining or supporting the American Climate Corps. Our first cohort will start their work this summer, and moving forward, anyone can learn more by visiting whitehouse.gov/Climate Corps. President Biden is already excited to scale American Climate Corps. That's why the president's budget requested funding to support an additional 50,000 American Climate Corps members by year 2031. So this is an integral part of what we're doing going forward, but I want to say it's really only part of how we're trying to think through the path to good paying jobs, whether or not And I want to be clear about the jobs we are focused on when it comes to renewable energy, resilience. We're focused on jobs for people who've graduated from college, but there really is a great opportunity for people who have not gone to college. Since the start of his administration, the president has invested in $440 million in registered apprenticeships. These apprenticeships have an average starting salary of $80,000, which is a clear ticket to the middle class. But they also provide real opportunities to ensure that to create jobs in particular clean energy projects. We've expanded career and technical education at high schools to create pathways for people into renewable jobs. Jobs in renewable industries, and we're also making investments to help high schools provide rigorous and engaging college and career pathways, particularly in areas like the environment and clean energy. And finally, in a sense, most importantly, we are creating a whole network of jobs and training around renewables. The president announced something called the 30 tech hubs across the nation. Each of these hubs are making investments to strengthen regions' capacity to manufacture, commercialize, and deploy technology. And an incredibly important focus for us in these jobs is our focus on renewable energy, as well as the whole panoply of jobs around climate. So from offshore wind programs in the Louisiana Gulf to battery manufacturing in New York to advanced technologies in South Carolina and Georgia Tech, tech hubs will drive clean energy innovation. They'll also develop the skilled, diverse workforce to achieve this change. the same time, we're deploying proven workforce approaches for critical energy sectors nationwide. Take battery manufacturing. The president has created nearly 300 newly expanded facilities that have been announced. EV sales have more than quadrupled. And this is a really important aspect of our entire work. We're not just investing in companies to be at the forefront of developing renewables. We're also investing in the workforce to ensure that people understand that our economy's growth really comes from our leadership. We talked a lot about polarization on this issue. The dean talked about polarization on this issue. And it's our bet as an administration that as our economy relies more and more on clean energy jobs and clean energy growth and innovation, that some of the partisanship and polarization we've seen, some of which is linked to industry who opposes these investments, but as more jobs in our economy rely on the clean energy and our response to climate, we hope we'll see less polarization in our Congress, less polarization in our state houses around these issues. Because at the end of the day, we believe in our bones in the administration. The president believes this. The vice president believes this. America's leadership on climate change will mean that we will lead economically, grow more stably, and have more growth that really moves us from the middle out and the bottom up. Thank you very much, and I'll take some questions.
I'm Bob Trum, the director of the Center for the Political Future. And I should say, Joe, we love partnering with you on this event every year. It's an honor to be here with you, Neera. And what you've said about the Climate Corps was both fascinating and encouraging. I've got a couple follow-ups.
Sure.
You say the first cohort shows up this summer. What will they do?
Yeah, so they're going to do all kinds of things. They'll work on all manners of activities related to climate and climate resilience. So that could be working on public lands where there are renewable projects. That could be and likely will be doing some response to climate-related events. That also includes weather, helping homes weatherize. Just today, the president, the vice president announced a $20 billion project, $20 billion of investments in ensuring that we are providing support to low-income people who need to weatherize their houses to address costs and to meet our climate goals, and they could engage in activity like that as well.
So all these folks will be working on that.
Yeah, all kind. I mean, it's very diverse panoply of climate-related activity, but it all, the idea of climate, and I will say, I do want to give a shout-out, Senator Sanders and Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez are leaders of this on this issue. It's an idea that we thought made a ton of sense, and it is also to, you know, like AmeriCorps has done, create a generation of people who really understand climate issues, but also are taking action on it. And we've seen with AmeriCorps, people who come together from diverse walks of life and then engage in an issue, can that also helps depolarize it because they actually understand the climate effects because that's what they'll be working on.
Yeah, it seems to me it's almost as fitting for this moment as the Civilian Conservation Corps mm-hmm. was for the challenge of the Great Depression and the Peace Corps was for the challenge of the Cold War. You also talked about apprenticeships, special programs in high schools. Will they prepare folks to work in these 30 tech hubs that are being established across the country?
Yes, they'll work. They establish the tech hubs are about particular areas of industry that we see significant promise. So as I said, there's a large-scale battery investments in upstate New York, and we'll also have our apprenticeship programs work on those areas. But the apprenticeship programs really do go beyond these particular tech hubs. Our focus in apprenticeships is to bring to create pathways to good-paying jobs for people, not necessarily with a four-year college degree. A kind of typical apprenticeship is works with community colleges and employers. We have seen a lot of leaders in renewables, solar jobs, elsewhere, really using apprenticeships to get a talented workforce to come in and be the workforce for what we have. We all know that unemployment is at relatively low levels right now, and getting more people into these jobs is a real challenge. As I like to say, you can build it, but if there's no one to work there, you can't really grow for the long term. So that is why the workforce is so important. But again, that's the moment that I think there's a real moment of opportunity now, because we have these levels of investment, particularly in climate related jobs, that we can ensure people who've been sometimes left behind in economic growth, communities of color, single moms, others. We really have an intentional program to bring them into jobs that are good middle-class jobs. And that's what the Registered Apprenticeship Program is focused on.
And so that's what the president means when he says grow the economy from the middle out or the middle up.
Yeah, the middle out and the bottom up.
Yeah.
Well, we could do middle up, because that's like a nice combo. So that's exactly what I mean.
So you've described some of the major changes in climate policy that President Biden and the administration have made. Do we really have a reasonable chance to meet our climate goals?
Yeah, I think, if you really step back 5-10 years, and I, as mentioned, I ran the Center for American Progress, which is a think tank in Washington, for about 10 years. And we had a big climate team. And so, I mean, if you think back, if you're going to think at a very high level where we are in the climate crisis, some things have advanced. Some things have advanced more expeditiously, faster than we thought, and some issues are more challenging. So I think, I defer to many of the climate experts in this room, but from my sense is, in some ways, the technology is advancing relatively quickly. We've made, when you look back at our projections 10 years ago or even 8 years ago, the potential of renewables has dramatically increased. Solar is much more affordable than it was just a few years ago. On the other hand, the climate crisis does seem to be accelerating given the number of climate-related events we have. So we are in a huge race. There is a lot of attention on any particular climate-seeming failure, but when you step back, the administration is reaching its goals on its strategy. So we have, there can be some negativity about electric vehicles, but there are more electric vehicles purchased every year than the year before. We are meeting our targets on electric charging. There's a lot of work to do, a lot of work we have done and is in process around CAFE standards. So it can, you can get wrapped up in some news here or some news there. But overall, we are making incredible progress. And I will say, we have seen just in the last 2 years, $650 billion in private sector investments in renewables in the U.S. and climate-related investments. That is a huge increase in investments, because I think, despite all the polarization and politics around these issues, economic leaders understand that this is an opportunity for the future and are betting their money on it.
I'm going to pick up on a whole lot of things you said in the last few minutes. We used to talk about the short term versus the long term here. The short term economics of a fossil fuel status quo versus the long term danger of a climate crisis. In light of recent weather events, which you just alluded to, I wonder if that taxonomy applies any longer. Is the climate crisis hitting sooner and harder than we once assumed, or is that just an illusion?
I think it's reasonable to act on what you see. And I think for many of us, it does feel like the climate crisis is having more significant climate impacts globally and in the United States than many predicted. And I do think it requires us to think really boldly about our actions. But I also think, as I said, it's like one can get like sort of steeped in gloom and doom about it. But on the other hand, the country is also, and the world is also, powering renewables in a much faster way than many predicted as well. But, these issues are contentious at every level, right? So it's a constant contest. It's not just in Congress. It's in state houses. It is in local communities. And so, we have to build intention and action everywhere we are. The Inflation Reduction Act which is the heart of the actions we've taken on climate, to have the big investments in renewables. That was a total party line vote in Congress. I still have some trauma to relive from that year-long debate on what was Build Back Better and then the climate investments. And it's not just climate investments, it's healthcare investments, it's a lot, but the climate investments were a key issue holding it up for many, 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 many months. But at the end of the day, Congress acted, Democrats passed this bill. And as I said, you know, it's important to remember that bill had levels of investment that no country has made into renewables to address the climate crisis. And that leadership is really important as we engage China and others on climate issues. We have President just had a call with President Xi of China on Tuesday morning. Climate is an area where we are continuing to work. We have a lot of areas of competition, but there are areas of collaboration, and climate can be one of them.
Let me talk about an area that's very contentious. As a country, we are obviously and hopefully in a transition that will be completed from fossil fuels to renewable. Mm-hmm. How will that transition work? And can oil and gas companies move to their own transitions so they and their workers, who might be 35, 40, 45 years old, will have a place in the new climate economy?
So that's why I think these investments are really, really critical. And they can be kind of boring to people and maybe not are at the cutting edge of every political discussion. But the reason why I think it's important that the president's framework, you know, and this has been for years, has been when, you know, and he says this all the time, when I think of climate, I think of jobs. The reason why that's important is we need to have, you know, people, whether it's healthcare or jobs, people can feel the absence of something so much easier than the possibility of an alternative. And that's why it's really important that we have a pathway that already exists for jobs in solar, in renewables, in battery plants, elsewhere. So it's not just like a hope of another job to replace a job in a fossil fuel industry. It is an exact, there is a real pathway there. And so, you know, it's important that those jobs are everywhere and that we, you know, in the Gulf of Louisiana, that we have wind opportunities. And Texas, you know, a very complicated state from our perspective, still has invested a lot in renewables, right? I mean, it is a clear champion of the fossil fuel industry, but it is also investing an incredible amount in wind and is a leader in the country on wind opportunities. And that's really important because you can't ask people to lose their jobs in a field where they can't see that. But that's why I see another path for themselves. But that's why this is really important.
And how do you communicate in such a way that people will get over the fear that if we deal with climate, they will lose their jobs?
Well, so that's exactly why at the heart, I think this is such a great question, because I'll kind of wax on this for a while, which is because, you know, as countries around the world have tried to deal with climate, you know, not just the United States, but other countries, we have seen the zero sum game play out. So in 2018 or 2019, Australia had its elections. And when I was president of the Center for American Progress, we had something called Global Progress, and we dealt with, we had sort of alliances with parties around the world, sort of center-left parties. And we were really looking at these Australian elections because Labor was really, everyone expected Labor to win. And in the last few, and Labor in Australia had made a huge push around climate. And, you know, they had kind of a traditional cap and trade approach to climate, to addressing climate. And in the last weeks before the election, not Republicans, because it's a different party, but the Conservative Party, the incumbent and Conservative Party ran a slashing attack ad saying that Labor's plans would raise taxes, raise gas prices, raise taxes on working class families. And Labor who had been winning, lost in a really sort of shocking way at the end. And at CAP, we developed a lot of plans around climate, and I am proud to say that the president took up many of our plans, and they formed the basis of the Inflation Reduction Act. But that was a really important lesson to us, which is, you know, it's hard to make change if things are just zero sum. In fact, that's a big debate. I think that's like part of our politics writ large, which is there are forces that want to make any kind of progressive change zero sum. And so our view at CAP was the way to deal with that, and the president's view in the election was the way to deal with that is to not make climate a zero sum, but to make it a, you know, in a sense, a plus plus, right? We would invest in renewables. We would invest in climate-related areas. And in doing so, and by subsidizing instead of punishing, and by subsidizing, we'd make climate investments much more affordable. But we wouldn't do it in a way that made it easy to attack as, you know, essentially harming people who are continually economically struggling. And I think that worked relatively well. Of course, there are far right attacks even on our subsidies and investments, and there are tough issues that we have to decide every day. But at the end of the day, subsidizing has made climate, solar, and renewables much more affordable in a way that has made it harder to attack as a zero sum. And I would argue has allowed the United States to lead the world in our investment agenda, to the point where now in Europe, they are also thinking through how they can have their own forms of Inflation Reduction Act. And that is the kind of global competition you want to see. You want to see a global competition of every country in the world trying to think about how they can capture a renewables market rather than, squander the moment we're in.
Footnote, I believe Labor is back in power in Australia.
They are. They are.
Are they pursuing the climate goals?
Yes, they're very aligned. They have a similar investing agenda, as does Labor in the UK and elsewhere.
You talked about the private sector, state and local governments. How can we incentivize them to act? Oil and gas companies can sit there and say, well, I'm making a lot of money doing this. Why would I move? And there are, I think, a number of states where there's a lot of resistance to acting on climate. How do we turn that around?
Our view is that we're investing, the federal government is investing in a range of arenas and directly in renewables and wind and offshore. And we have an approach to really subsidize a whole range of renewables. And, you know, truthfully, those tax credits are oversubscribed. Some have been critical that the tax credits we've done to kind of spur new companies in these arenas. The fact that we've faced some criticism from the right that these tax credits have ballooned more than the projections. But what that actually means is we're having more companies, more economic growth tied to renewables. That's better. That's one of the reasons why we're so optimistic about hitting our targets. The numbers are greater than we projected. And so I think that's the best way, is to actually show that you can have economic growth, you can create jobs, your community can be a siting of good jobs instead of thinking, that is actually the best way to incentivize this activity, is to actually show how you can have economic growth in your community with good, stable jobs from climate, and that's why you should make the transition yourself.
Do you see corporations beginning to understand that it's actually very profitable to invest in resilience, sustainability, and countering climate change?
If you actually just think about the economy and not the political rhetoric, we are seeing a huge range of investments in climate-related activities. As I said, even just in the first year we've had of the Inflation Reduction Act, we've had $650 billion of private sector investment in renewables and climate-related activity. And so that dwarfs what our expectation was. I think that's a huge sign of success. Wall Street is investing in these areas. I don't really trust the rhetoric of particular companies that have been engaged in the fossil fuel industry, but I would say other actors have been have really come to the table.
So you're saying you're trying to put the profit motive into countering climate change?
Yeah, I mean, we want people to have good paying jobs and we want economic growth. And that is, you know, that's all to the good, you know. And again, we would like, and this is an area, solar and other areas are places where other countries years ahead of us, including China, have thought about how they can try to win this competition. The fact that the United States is such a big player and such a growing player is good. Again, as I'd say, good for our economy today, but ultimately, it's our hope, not our expectations, because we don't, polarization is really intense, but it's our hope that as more people actually have jobs from this field, it'll be a little harder for, some to just say they want to get rid of all these investments.
Yeah. You've referred to polarization a couple of times. How can we counter the rising polarization-driven opposition to electric vehicles, which has become more and more manifest over the last few months?
Yeah, I don't know. It's very weird to me. But I mean, I think first of all, it's important to remember some of the facts. You know, there's more, as I said, there are more people purchasing electric vehicles every year. I have an electric vehicle. I love my electric vehicle. I didn't really think of it as like a Democratic
but
Party
it's almost
action.
Like a, it's almost like a political statement, people seem to think.
I know, but I mean, I do think that that's sort of weird. I guess I would welcome others' views on how we handle that. But there are all these ways in which basic decisions have become polarized and into some kind of red team, blue team thing that doesn't make much sense. And I think truly we just... It can get dispiriting, and I sometimes think the world seems upside down, but it's important to remember that most people actually still do care about facts. Most people think climate is an urgent problem. Most people, the climate investments we've made as a country are very popular. It's important to, I think, actually deal with these issues just like with facts and try to handle them as just regular run-of-the-mill thing instead of making them red team, blue team issues. Our goal and the president's goal for sure is always to try to, you know, to fight back where we need to, but depolarize where we can.
You seem to have depolarized or departisanized the patterns of investment that you're making on these climate initiatives.
Yeah. No. And, you know, I mean, there's lots of investments. Sometimes people find this irritating, but there are lots of investments in red states right now in climate investments. I mean, there's plants going up in Ohio, in the South, and there it's like interesting. You do sort of see kind of political leaders both celebrate those investments and new battery plants in Georgia, for example, or EV cars in particular locations. And sort of have a separate rhetoric. And then our hope is that overall they'll move. I mean, you can't really, I mean, I've been at this a while. So I've been at politics and policy a while. So I'm not really, you know, I never plan based on hope. I always plan more like for the worst case scenario. But you know, as more and more people's jobs are connected to the areas of growth, hopefully we'll see a little less of this. I mean, what's fascinating is, you know, I think I don't want to get anyone in trouble, but Texas is like a fascinating example, right? It's like very hard rhetoric, hard right rhetoric. At the same time, you know, they have been leading the country in wind power investments and wind power. I mean, you fly over Texas, you can see these massive wind power examples. So that's not the first time in politics where people have said one thing and done another. But, you know, it's better that they do the right thing and say the wrong thing than do the wrong thing and say the right thing.
You know, it's interesting. In Texas, it was the very conservative T. Boone Pickens who in the second chapter of his corporate life really invested and made billions of dollars from wind power.
Yep. Because when you can make money, then you just start to like something.
So... what makes you hopeful that we'll respond in time to the climate challenge rather than waiting to witness more and more dire events like coastal cities being devastated by rising sea levels, far more intense storms doing far more damage?
You know, I think it's very easy to become very cynical about politics. You know, I understand there's a lot in the news that makes people very cynical about politics, and politics in America does not respond always urgently to urgent crises. But I would say when you step back, we had leaders who represent very conservative states. Obviously, everyone focuses on one leader from West Virginia, but there's other leaders who, at the end of the day, did vote for large-scale investments in renewables because they do understand that there is a climate crisis in our country, and they did want to see renewable energy grow. But, you know, if they just had done a hard case calculation of jobs, they might have gone one direction. But I do think people have really did step up. And there's a lot more work to do on climate, but I don't think we should jump over the fact that we had, with a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic House, although it did take a very long time, we made world-changing investments in the United States that have had ripple effects to countries around the world. With the climate crisis, it's always easy to say it's not enough, it's never enough. But I also think there's a problem in progressive politics where we don't celebrate successes sufficiently, because when you don't celebrate successes sufficiently, you help create a fatalism that really just hurts action. So my sense is it's really important for us to celebrate. It's always good to push. It's always good to advocate. Leaders, I've been on the advocacy side and I've been in government. Things don't happen unless large groups of people are acting to push them. But at the same time, if you don't tell the country about your successes, it becomes very easy to become fatalistic. And the worst thing to make policy change is a fatalism that nothing can get done, because then we just sit by and watch as more and more terrible things happen. So that's my sort of my plea, which is we should definitely push and push and push, but people also have to acknowledge the incredible victories that have happened in the last couple of years, where the United States, which has always been far behind in the global arena, has really led the world. And that is an important thing, not just for the Biden-Harris administration, but for future generations. And so, you know, and again, it didn't happen just from us. It was like leaders pushing and advocacy and change. But let's like also celebrate that win as, you know, as it will be attacked over the next year.
Yeah, you're right. Democrats do have or progressives often do have a problem celebrating. Instead, they think it's always going to rain. And of course, if you're in California this winter, that happens to be the case.
We hear about violence all the time in the news, yet we rarely hear stories about peace. There are so many people who are working hard to promote solutions to violence, toxic polarization, and authoritarianism, often at great personal risk. We never hear about these stories, but at what cost? On Making Peace Visible, we speak with journalists, storytellers, and peace builders who are on the front lines of both peace and conflict. You can find Making Peace Visible wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're going to move to audience questions. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Tannen, for being here. I have a question for you in relation to the workforce training to meet the needs of the various technologies, meaning climate change. In many middle schools and high schools in the United States, particularly in public schools, the setback from the COVID era has been so significant in math, writing, so many skills. A lot of kids are still left behind now. And my question is for you, I know the administration has set, I think, 3 goals for getting kids back on track. But my question is for you is, what other challenges do you see moving forward with projects like Climate Corps and other areas that education will be important? And are there any plans to address that backlog of kids who are still struggling to get behind before it's too late?
Thank you. That's a great question. So let me just talk about this for 1 minute. So you're talking about learning loss. And so what we know about our K-12 schools in the last couple of years is many schools, many states are still struggling with learning loss in the sense that education is not, schools are not at their pre-pandemic levels. On the other hand, what's also interesting is the United States actually has recovered more than other countries, most other countries, and they recovered in states that had closed and states that had not closed. So this whole polarizing debate about school closures, somewhat misleading. The administration has a three-part strategy to deal with learning loss and getting kids, getting all of our school systems back to pre-pandemic levels. Many states are making progress on this and very close to it. Some states are farther behind. But our three-part strategy is focused on evidence-based strategies, and they're high-dosage tutoring, summer school and after school, and addressing absenteeism. Absenteeism is a huge challenge, and that really is recreating the norm that kids have to be in school. It's a very basic topic, very basic kind of cultural norm we have to recreate, which is, you know, essentially understanding that kids can't learn if they're not in school, and absenteeism a big component. I could actually talk about this for 3 hours instead of 3 minutes, but it is a big focus for our administration and it's a big focus for the president. And we are working directly with states and schools to get that evidence-based approach so that we can make a, so that we have in the next year our all of our states at pre-pandemic levels.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Over here.
Hi. I just heard you talking about EVs, and I think it's interesting when we go to conferences where we kind of are only hearing about investment in EVs, and we never really hear a word about mass public transport, especially when batteries and EV vehicles are a band-aid to a gaping wound. It kind of feels like pandering to the auto industry as well as individualism, which is one of the root causes of all these problems. Furthermore, why should young people have any faith in democracy when many of these climate and even non-climate policies could be, but are not written permanently into law and could easily be overturned by the next president? And as Politico said itself in an article this past March.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, Biden's approaches have, and I quote, cleared the way for new oil and gas projects on federal land.
Do you have a question? You're giving a speech. Do you have a question?
Yeah. So how come Biden hasn't made any of these policies permanent, and why don't we ever hear about actual solutions like mass public transport?
What policies have we not made permanent?
Thank you so much. His approaches have cleared the way for new oil and gas projects on federal land, not, as climate activists have heard, urged a commitment to keep those fuels in the ground.
So just to be clear, that the Inflation Reduction Act did actually pass as law, and that the tax credits and investments we've made are all law. So I would say that factually we have made a series of actions that are permanent. Now, to go to your point, though, laws can change, and every Republican has committed to get rid of the Inflation Reduction Act and all of our investments. So I would also just say that I think it's really important to put pressure on us, but we do have, I think this is a hugely important issue. I just would welcome people to also recognize that there are leaders who think climate is a hoax, who voted against all of our investments, have voted against all of our activities to address climate. And I would welcome people to challenge them as well.
Thank you. Free Palestine.
Yeah, over here.
First of all, thank you for coming and speaking. I'm going to go out on a limb and say you've done a fantastic job, you and the administration, addressing our climate crisis. So first of all, thank you for that as well.
Thank you.
My question is, even though you handled domestic policy, it's, you know, obvious you need to address that we're in this fight together with every country across the world. As a result, the United States is dependent on other countries for energy needs, for minerals, just to, you know, facilitate our transition. So how do you ensure that, you know, with all the domestic agenda you're doing, you're not at the same time jeopardizing our energy security or just our national security and ensuring an effective transition?
Yeah, I think that's an important issue. And I think what we're trying to say, though, is that it's important for the world to lead on climate related issues. And actually, countries throughout the world should recognize that there will be a climate transition. It's actually, you can go to countries as wide ranging as, you know, countries in the Middle East or Europe or even Asia. And there's much more of an acceptance of climate change as a reality. And many leaders throughout the world are thinking about how they make their own climate transitions. And we interact with the National Security Council and the National Economic Council to try to and obviously led by the Climate Policy Office to ensure that all of our equities are addressed, but you have to set a North Star in administration, and our North Star is addressing the climate challenge in a way that builds support over the long term.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Todd Campbell. I'm with Clean Energy, a company that was co-founded by Mr. Pickens himself. And not sure he made billions of dollars on wind farms, but
he did very well.
He did well. And I would say one of the things about Boone is that he always thought, you know, we should set performance standards and create, you know, allow for entrepreneurialism to grow. And I want to thank you, by the way, for being here today. And I applaud the Biden administration for its leadership. My only issue is, and you mentioned facts a number of times, you know, I think facts are important too. When we're looking for the future of transportation, could the Biden administration possibly look at more of a performance-based approach? Because the facts are, we don't have the infrastructure up and running for an electric future yet, especially in the heavy-duty sector. We certainly have to double or triple our energy capacity. And we're still waiting for a Tesla semi to be delivered. I mean, it's nice that Lays and, you know, other, you know, companies, some companies that are testing these things out. But we really want to get to a future that is decarbonized. And being someone who grew up and lives in Los Angeles, a extreme non-attainment zone, and someone who's worked on mobile sources, I'm tired of diesel winning. Mm-hmm. And I really would like to see the administration be more abrasive of multiple technologies that can get us to near zero, if not zero emissions. And I'll tell you, clean energy not only invests in those technologies, but also invests in hydrogen, because we want to get to the zero emission future with you.
Well, you know of some of the advancements with hydrogen and others, and obviously we've had a lot of investment in hydrogen. So I would say, I hear the import of your question on some of these issues. I think this is always a balance in public policy, which is, how do we create forward momentum in this arena, electric vehicles, right? And to the extent we take our, no pun intended, our foot off the gas with our forward momentum around electric vehicles, you know, you can see a lot of backsliding. So that is the tension we're always dealing with on electric vehicles and other issues in climate. We want to make sure that we're setting industry on an important path forward. Obviously, there are always challenges and bumps in the road in any of those efforts. And we're always trying to be practical. But when you pull back on some of your goals, then, you know, you can see significant backsliding. So that's the tension. But I really appreciate the question, and I'll ensure that others in the administration hear it.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Josiah. I'm a student and organizer, climate justice organizer with Sunrise Movement. And okay. I do want to celebrate the American Climate Corps' passage because, well, as you mentioned before, it was the Inflation Reduction Act. It was Build Back Better. Before it was the American Climate Corps, it was the Civilian Climate Corps. And it's important to celebrate those wins, but also important to recognize the limitations that that come with some of those wins, particularly as we exist in a context of a Republican-controlled House. And so Sunrise has shifted its priorities to the declaration of a climate emergency by the federal government. And so my question for you is, what do you think about, it's a two-part question, what do you think about the importance of declaring climate emergency? And will you pressure or ask the president to declare or at least advocate for the declaration of a climate emergency?
Can I interject one thing? Having been around White Houses, I would say you don't pressure the president.
Advocate.
Yeah.
Advocate.
The climate emergency is a declaration of the climate emergency is an issue that I know a lot of folks in the White House are focused on. The Climate Policy Office is leading on this. And I think the balance of this issue, or just the substance of this issue, is the president has said there's a climate emergency. He doesn't feel like there isn't a climate emergency. And I know it's being debated and discussed. I'm not going to, just to be super candid with you, I'm not going to like disclose our conversations in the White House. But I know it's one that like is at the very high levels discussed like right now. So I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
One more, I think.
Hi, Neera. I'm Dana. On the subject of climate emergency, we have a current in the Atlantic Ocean, which is approaching a tipping point. Mm-hmm. You know, the Atlantic Ocean current affects temperature and climate around the planet. I know that there are platforms of sequestration around the ocean, certain parts of the ocean, to try to do carbon sequestration. Is there any research being done to urgently deal with this current problem in the ocean?
You know, I'm not tracking that research, but I will definitely ask our climate team. Thank you.
I think if we can get a short question, a short answer, we'll be fine. Go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to ask if you feel that the potential for regulation to help the transition between fossil fuels and renewables is underutilized. You've talked a lot about the job pathway and the investment pathway today. But for example, in the United States, LNG export capacity is likely to double in like the next 3 years. And so how do we pull back from that?
Well, I mean, the president just announced a policy on LNG.
Yeah, so permitting was paused, but the existing facilities are still being built.
I mean, I would recommend, like, there is this big, one of the big reasons for LNG is the Ukraine war and the fact that there's limited amounts of resource for Ukraine. So we should just acknowledge the interconnections of those issues.
If we don't supply some gas to Europe, then everybody's going to freeze because they were dependent for a long time on Russian gas. They're trying to transition away from it.
Yeah, I understand.
We're not going to have a debate. I mean, I think that's an honest answer, but and I think your concern is very real, and I get it. And
it animated the president's actions. So I think that's a really important part of this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. That's all we have time for on this panel. I want to thank our audience here in Town and Gown.
Thank you.
On Zoom and Facebook Live. And those of you who will engage with this session on our Bully Pulpit podcast. And let me, on behalf of all of us, express our gratitude to Neera Tanden for taking the time and traveling here to share her brilliance, her insights, and her commitment.
Thank you for joining us on the Bully Pulpit. It helps us a lot when you subscribe and rate the show 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at @USCPOLFuture. That's @USCPOLFuture. Follow us on Facebook and YouTube, and visit our website for upcoming programs.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.